I'm Jack Beattie. This is The Connection. A British newspaper called Barry Goldwater stupid to a degree that is incredible. They had in mind Goldwater's political suicide performed before millions at the meridian of his triumph. To a nation still shaken by the assassination of John F. Kennedy, by terrorism against civil rights workers in the South, and by riots in northern cities, Barry Goldwater accepting his party's nomination for president at the Cow Palace in San Francisco in July 1964 said,
"Anyone who joins us, in all sincerity, we welcome. Those who do not care for our cause, we don't expect to enter our ranks in any case. I would remind you that extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. And let me remind you also that moderation in the pursuit of justice is no virtue."
Connection listeners, if we thought Goldwater's defeat marked the end of conservatism, were we ever wrong? The 1960s marked the end of liberalism. As a matter of historical consequence, the significance of sex, drugs, the Beatles, the anti-war movement, and the other 60s turbulences were that they ended up driving Mr. and Mrs. Front Porch to the right. Connection listeners, how does it feel to have history deal so cruelly with your image of the 1960s? And whose America do we live in today? LBJ's or Barry Goldwater? Make the Barry We Hardly Knew Ye connection at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me in the studio today is Rick Perlstein, author of Before the Storm, Barry Goldwater and the Unmaking of the American Consensus. Welcome to The Connection, Rick.
Joy to be here, Jack.
And I should say, he corrected me in my lead-in. I had LBJ saying, what has Barry Goldwater done for Culpepper? Actually, it was, what has Richard Nixon done for Culpepper? But Barry did vote against the Civil Rights Act. Let's talk about three things. The movement behind Barry Goldwater, the man and the candidate, and third, how man and movement helped to undermine this American post-war consensus.
Sure.
The movement.
The movement. Well, let's broaden that one out. The American post-war consensus that I'm referring to is, you know, what happened in the 50s. It was Eisenhower's America, tail fin America, you know, suburban Levittown America. And beneath it all was this overriding conviction held by people, even if, though it wasn't necessarily true on the ground, that America was a society united and at peace with itself, and that extremism on any side of the political divide was neither welcome nor necessary. And kind of what makes Barry Goldwater interesting, even more so than as the person who led this conservative revival in 1964, is that he was a part of a more widespread revival of people questioning the consensus from all sides of the perspective. Martin Luther King, Rachel Carlson, William F. Buckley. Martin Luther King also complained about being called an extremist in his letter from a Birmingham jail. Mm-hmm. So what we have here is the beginning of the 60s as we know them, where Americans now see themselves at each other's throats.
Mm-hmm. And the movement specifically behind Barry, how did all this get going? Who were the players? What was the cause?
Sure. Well, before Barry Goldwater, you had people like Robert Taft, who was an Ohio senator, who was the conservative leader, very boring, dry guy for all, you know, his various worthy accomplishments, and Senator Joseph McCarthy. Neither of them were particularly attractive leaders. Taft died in 1957, I think, around then. And, of course, McCarthy was badly discredited in 1954 in the Armey-McCarthy hearings. And but with them did not die, you know, the sentiments that they represented. And it was really a rump group of folks. I consider their social base originally to have been largely made up of people surrounding kind of Midwestern factory towns, mm-hmm. who held to what were seen as vestigial virtues of, you know, raw entrepreneurship, hatred of the activist state.
Hatred of unions.
hatred of unions. That was really the forming gesture of these people. That's what united them into a political movement, was none other than the great UAW leader, Walter Reuther. And then a parallel formation in the late 50s, which is perhaps a bit more surprising, is that college kids coming onto American campuses during this great boom of the multiversity, the baby boom, start asking the kind of questions that we tend to associate more with the left. Is authority too overbearing? Is freedom, liberty, individual license too beaten down?
And they had a Bible. I remember the book. I remember friends of mine reading it, "The Conscience of a Conservative" by Barry Goldwater. Not a word of which did Barry write, but.
Not a word of which Barry Wright. You can fairly say that it was, you know, conceived in his spirit.
But it was a real important. It was a very important book. I mean,
it sold only like a million copies that first year, and it was practically produced in someone's basement. And the reason for it is, at least as I theorize in my book, Before the Storm, is that what Barry Goldwater was talking about is we conservatives believe in freedom for bureaucracy. We want to remove you from the grinding gears of the social machine. And it sounded like groovy stuff, really similar to some of the rhetoric that was coming from people like C. Wright Mills, like John Hayden.
Port Huron statement of Tom Hayden and SDS talking about impersonal machines.
Striking parallels. And what you have is a new generation that grew up in this post-war prosperity, this post-scarcity prosperity, having forgotten about the Depression, asking why should politics be limited to these, you know, these kind of milquetoast issues of who gets what and when, and begin to quest after a politics that really kind of answers to the needs of the soul. And, you know, it's hard for liberals to hear that. We disagree with the solutions they chose. But at least at that period of time, the similarity in the rhetoric was the most important thing. And it's important to remember that in the early 60s, it was the conservatives that came first out of the box. You had journalists saying things like, you have to admit that conservatism is the youth movement of the 60s. Mm. This is in 1961.
Indeed. All right, the man and the candidate.
Barry Goldwater was, in many ways, a political curiosity. He's a slightly more complex figure than we remember. He's remembered as this rather avuncular guy, pleasant to be around, fun-loving, freewheeling. And for that, he's, you know, often greatly admired, different from the ordinary politician. He also was different from the ordinary politician in a way that I think is not so admirable, which was that he tended to be thrusted into positions of leadership, accept them, and then be so ambivalent about it that he would kind of cut and run at the sight of a fight. So he wasn't necessarily the strongest politician, but he really did believe in these conservative principles, and he always saw his role as, in a metaphor really that I used throughout the book, as a salesman. Salesman for a cause. That's what Time called him in their cover article in June of 1963.
Mm-hmm. And the cause was conservatism. As a candidate, he was, not to put too fine a point on it, calamitous.
Calamitous.
Give us some of the flavor.
You're being so gentle, Jim.
Give us some of the... Well, his supporters were terribly disappointed by the way he campaigned. He would go to... Well, give us the litany. He would go to Iowa and come out against farm programs.
Right. These are famous stories. He really relished the idea of, in a fairly adolescent way, I would argue, of just going to a place in which he is expected to say one thing and saying exactly the opposite. So he goes to a place like West Virginia and says the war on poverty is a sham, and everyone boos him as he leaves. You know, he goes to a place like Florida and says, you know, Social Security is nonsense. You know, he speaks to a group of farmers in the middle of Minnesota and saying, you know, the real problem racking the world and that you really need to concern yourself about is crime. And these are, you know, farmers.
Right, right.
He dug it. You know, he was
sure.
Groovy that way.
And his biggest problem, really, as a candidate, was he just couldn't keep his tongue off nuclear weapons, could he? He spoke at one point of lobbing a nuke into the men's room of the Kremlin.
He did.
And this reinforced this image from the Cow Palace speech we heard that he was an extremist. And it was the context for the most famous political ad in TV history. Set it up for us, and we'll play it for our listeners.
Sure. Well, you know, talking about nuclear weapons was never a popular thing for any politician to do. Not to say that it was never done before.
But the ad itself here.
Right.
The ad itself is taken out by the...
Right. Lyndon Johnson and his folks are talking about what kind of campaign strategy to pursue. Should we play up our strengths on civil rights? They decide not to because they realize even then that civil rights is too chancy a political issue. And on one of the... Johnson tapes at the Johnson Library, George Reedy pipes up that they should hit the kids with two heads issue. In other words, the idea of kids being born with two heads because of
radioactive
nuclear fallout.
Kids.
And Lyndon Johnson loved that idea. He said, you know, these are the things that these final things, the issues of life or death, or what people really call about, really care about. So he conceded this ad with his advertising agency that really hit people at this kind of lizard brain unconscious level.
And the image here is of a little girl.
Little girl plucking petals off a daisy. And you still see that kind of innocent image. And then suddenly there's the nuclear countdown.
Yeah, we're going to hear it right now.
Bring it on.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 8, 9, 12, 13, 16, 18, 10. These are the stakes to make a world in which all of God's children can live, or to go into the dark. We must either love each other, or we must die.
Well, it ran once, and its fallout, so to speak, was pretty much deadly for Barry, wasn't it?
It was deadly for Barry. You know, I recount the scene at the White House at the time when the thing ran. You know, Johnson gets on the horn, calls his number one assistant, Bill Moyer, says, get in here right away. We're being flooded by our switchboard is being flooded by complaints about this thing. LBJ pauses, chuckles. He says, well, we did exactly what we set out to do, which was disturb people, stir up these stored images people had in their minds. Didn't mention Goldwater once in the ad. It just relied all on unconscious senses.
Sure.
And lo and behold, that's all anyone talked about from pretty much then on in. It was startlingly effective.
And, of course, as you say, this same firm was going to do a series of ads making LBJ the new Lincoln for his sponsorship of the Civil Rights Act, but they decided not to run those.
They called off the snarling dogs, as it were.
And that for a good reason, because the political situation within the country regarding race after the Civil Rights Act was changing and changing rapidly.
That's right. And Lyndon Johnson was terrified of what they called in those days, and sometimes we still do, backlash politics.
Mm-hmm.
Even though he was winning by, 25% in the polls, he'd still say this could change any day if there's a race riot.
Ah, yes. Connection listeners, we're talking about Barry Goldwater today. His legacy informs our present-day politics more than you ever thought. Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And tell us, do you think it's Barry Goldwater's we live in today or LBJ's? I'm Jack Beatty. This is The Connection on NPR. I'm Jack Beatty. This is The Connection, and this is Lyndon Baines Johnson. Talking about the Great Society, which he first introduced in the spring of 1964 in a famous speech at the University of Michigan. And in the speech we have, he's speaking in the State of the Union in 1965. Now we'll hear Lyndon Baines.
We have the opportunity to move not only toward the rich society and the powerful society, but upward to the great society. The great society rests on abundance and liberty for all. It demands an end to poverty and racial injustice, to which we're totally committed in our time.
How appropriate to hear that on National Public Radio, a legacy of the Great Society. That was Lyndon B. Johnson in January 1965 when he was embarking on what was to be his creation of the Great Society. We're talking about Barry Goldwater today, the election of 1964, and rethinking our view of who really won that election. Lyndon B. Johnson trampled Goldwater at the polls, but who's running the country now? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With me in the studio today is Rick Perlstein, author of Before the Storm. And joining us now from Washington, D.C. is Robert Dalek, Boston University professor and author of a monumental two-volume biography of Lyndon Johnson, Lone Star Rising and Flawed Giant. Bob Dalek, welcome.
Thanks, Jack. Good to be with you.
Great to have us. Now, we ended with the note of the white backlash. Take us into the Johnson campaign. Let's talk about three of its challenges: the white backlash, the ghost of JFK, and Vietnam.
Sure. Well, the white backlash was something was very much on Johnson's mind. In fact, when the 64 Civil Rights Act passed, and then, of course, in 65, he got the Voting Rights Act passed, he was very worried that there might be riots in the South over these pieces of legislation, and particularly over the Civil Rights Bill, which was going to work a revolution in the social mores across the South. Excuse me. And Richard Russell eventually said that the reason you didn't get explosion of animus across the South is because this was legislation enacted by Congress. If this had been done by the courts, you might well have seen riots. So Johnson wasn't so far off base there. And also, of course, he famously said to Bill Moyers after the legislation passed, we've probably given away the South to the Republican Party for as far into the future as anyone can see. And, of course, he was absolutely right, because the solid Democratic South of the 1930s and 1940s and earlier is, of course, now largely a solid Republican South. So there was real concern on his part over this white backlash. Secondly, the shadow of JFK, Johnson understood perfectly that Kennedy had now become a martyr, and that everything Johnson did, I would say, between Kennedy's assassination and Johnson's election in his own right, was very much colored by the fact that Kennedy was a martyr. And Johnson, you read his speeches, and he invokes Kennedy repeatedly. After he's elected in his own right, Kennedy fades out of his speeches. He's nowhere near as front and center as he was in that period before Johnson gets elected in November of 64. Vietnam, what Johnson does with Vietnam, it's a deep concern to him. He's not going to lose Vietnam. He says that from day one to the American ambassador to Vietnam, Henry Cabot Lodge. But he wants to put this on the shelf during the 1964 campaign. And he's worried also that Goldwater is going to get to the right of him on this issue. And so when there is an attack in the Gulf of Tonkin by North Vietnamese PT boats on an American destroyer, Johnson gets from the United States Congress a resolution, the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, to give him sort of blanket authority to do what needs to be done to protect freedom. And Johnson, of course, amusingly said that he loved the resolution. It was just like grandma's nightshirt. It covered everything. it gave him what he wanted, was a position there on the right, and nobody was going to outdo him as a Cold Warrior.
And it pretty much removed Vietnam from the campaign.
It did. It did. And, of course, it came back to haunt us for years to come, but it really put it on the shelf in 64.
Rick Perlstein?
Yeah, it did. Barry Goldwater was the kind of guy who wasn't ready to defy his president. It's not something you did in the good patriotic days before, well, I won't go there. So he pretty much told Lyndon Johnson, I'm not going to make Vietnam a political issue. People remember him, you know, saying all these hawkish things about Vietnam, but, you know, he didn't really talk about it much.
He did talk about using nuclear weapons there, though, didn't he?
That was earlier in the campaign. Mm-hmm. He talked about using tactical nuclear weapons to defoliate the, what we'll call them, the safe havens in Laos and Cambodia. But then again, so did Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon. Mm-hmm. I mean, often, as far as that nuclear stuff went, Richard Nixon, I mean, Goldwater got in trouble for talking about things in public that other politicians were smart enough not to talk about.
Mm-hmm. We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Steve is calling from Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
All right.
You'd mentioned earlier, you sort of wondered why maybe conservatives were running the show after this war on poverty was launched 30 years ago in 64. And I would say that more than likely, it's because it's been a complete and total failure. We still have poverty with us today.
Bob Dalek?
Well, I wouldn't go that far. You know, there's lots of talk about the fact that we've had a conservative movement that dissolved the Great Society, that repudiated. But, you know, when you look at what Johnson passed, civil rights, voting rights, Medicare, federal aid to education, environmental protections of all kind, immigration reform, you know, you can see that almost every one of the major initiatives that he took are still in place. Food stamps, Head Start. Now, it's true, of course, there is poverty in the country, and Johnson's political failure, I think, was that he oversold this idea.
Though it is way down since the 60s.
Well, no, wait a minute. The rate of poverty as a percentage of the population is exactly the same.
No, it isn't. No, it isn't. Under Johnson, when he came in, poverty in the country reached into about 22% of the population. After Johnson launched his war on poverty, and this may have had as much to do with the spending, of course, on the Vietnam War as it ever had to do with the actual spending on the war on poverty, because they didn't spend huge amounts of money on it.
But they brought it down to
about 11%, and it's now about, I believe, about 14-15%.
Well, now, as you just explained a minute ago, his legacy is the fact that he established all these programs. So, I mean, I guess I put to you that there's been a tremendous amount of money spent,
well,
and that these and it's continuing to be spent today, and we're not seeing an uplifting. So I guess my point is we've thrown a lot of money at these issues, and I don't know that you could make the same argument about Star Wars. You're going to throw a lot of money at it, and it's probably not going to work. We've thrown a lot of money at this, and it's not working.
Steve, thanks for your call. Of course, one of the things you point out, Bob Dalek, in your biography is that the war in Vietnam pretty much ate up the resources for the war on poverty. And to give Steve his due, the war on poverty was very poorly conceived, as you point out, Rick Perlstein. Give us a quick sense of that, just how casual this whole thing was put together. Casually, this was put together, Bob Dalek.
Messy as a Texas barbecue, I'd say.
Yeah. In other words, there was no clear. If you had said to Lyndon Johnson, "How are you going to end poverty?" he wouldn't have given you a coherent answer. Isn't that right, Bob Dalek?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. And in fact, what's striking about the war on poverty is how many people went on to the welfare rolls as a consequence of this war on poverty.
Well, I think this is what Steve is bringing up. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it expanded by something like 3 to 4 times what it had been, because a lot of the people who were enlisted in the inner city work for the war on poverty went around telling people, listen, you know, under the new rules, you can get on the welfare rolls, mm-hmm. and the welfare rolls expanded like mad. But still, I think it's unfair to say that massive amounts of money was spent specifically on that. My understanding is they spent about $3 billion, and they began spending $10, $12 billion a year on the Vietnam War. Mm. So essentially, that war on poverty was stalled. Now, I'm not making a case for the idea that we go back and start spending $12 billion on something that, as you were both saying, and I think you're absolutely right, was so imprecise, and Johnson himself wasn't sure. Was it a throwback to the New Deal? Were you going to have a CCC and an NYA? Or was it going to be some kind of new initiative? So they were puzzled themselves.
Sure.
But, you know, I wanted to come back to something that I thought was very interesting that both of you were talking about earlier on. That 64 campaign, you see, I think is such an interesting divide in reflecting the whole history of American politics. Because what you have in this country is a very long history of division, of debate, argument over the role of government in American life. Should it play a big role? Should we have a war on poverty? Should you cut taxes? Should you increase them? How much regulation do you want? And we see this being fought out today in this current Bush administration, with feelings on the part of a lot of people that this is very much an administration that reflects business sentiment or big business sentiment and wants to walk away from many of the past initiatives that the federal government took and is responsible for. So this is an ongoing debate, and in a sense, that's what the debate was about in 64, and it goes on. It existed before. And in the
Bob, I've been reading some literature on the colonial period, and you can even look at the raging debates in the 1780s, 1790s, about the size, role, and scope of the federal government. One of the founding divides of our country.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, it's just something that I think will probably go on forever in this country. And, of course, the difference was that in the 30s, conservatism was repudiated by Herbert Hoover's actions and by the failure of him of his administration to deal with the Depression, and Roosevelt becoming such a heroic figure. And that was kind of overdrawn. And then there was a reaction against that by the 1950s with Eisenhower. So it kind of goes in cycles, and when one group fails, the other one, so to speak, comes in to fill the vacuum, and then we go back and forth.
Sure. Thanks, Bob Dalek. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Sam is on the line. Hello.
Yes. I'd like to ask the conservative member of your team there the following question.
Which one is that?
Well, isn't there a person there that's sort of... a conservative, or...
Well, I wrote about Goldwater, but I consider myself the left of liberal.
Oh, yeah, well, my question is, how do you explain the fact that Goldwater, in his later years, espoused positions which are quite different from today's conservative? He was for gay rights, and he also was for abortion rights. How do you explain that transformation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, one of the reasons was he was a guy who loved to raise hell, and that was a pretty efficient way to do it in the 80s and 90s when these things were really swelling up. You know, there's speculation. He may have changed his views, softened his views. He had a personal experience with abortion. He took his daughter to get an abortion. He got old. He retired. Maybe his wife affected him. But the important thing historically to look at is these were not political issues before 1964. They just weren't on the radar screen as things that presidential candidates were expected to talk about. It was seen that there was a consensus on most of these things. Abortion was illegal.
Well, I was just thinking, if you extrapolate to today, Goldwater would be considered a liberal.
Well, but in one sense was he, I think, very much a consistent conservative, which is that he always believed in individualism. And this is as American as apple pie and a good old conservative proposition. And he was an individualist. He had his views on things, and he wasn't going to be pushed in one direction or the other by the current wisdom or
It was a psychology. He hated to be framed and boxed and pushed around.
Yeah,
and he was a libertarian.
That's right.
He was not a social conservative, as the way we understand a sort of Jerry Falwell.
I have to disagree with that a little, actually. Yeah, that's kind of we like to see each generation sees the last generation's conservatives as more comforting than the ones we have now. It's a funny paradox. It repeats itself over and over again. In Goldwater's day, people talked about how warm and cuddly and likable Robert Taft was compared to Goldwater, even though in their own day they called him a fascist. But, you know, Goldwater in 1964 really introduced the rhetoric that Falwell would pick up later. Mm-hmm. He talked about crime in the streets. He talked about loose morals. He talked about people not going to church. You know, he was a conservative. Certainly then. Mm-hmm. It would be certainly be doing a violence to the historical record to say that he was a libertarian in 1964. Mm-hmm. He was and more.
Sure. Thank you. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jerry is calling from Burlington, Vermont. Hello.
Hi. I lived through those days. It was like the beginning of the anti-war movement, you know, pretty early on there. And civil rights, and what you, the list that you just said that attributed to, that accrued to Goldwater's right-wing positions. Don't forget civil rights, you know. I don't care how it's rationalized, you know. He was the one who made that division, and apparently successfully. But my question really is that what happened? I have a view, but my question is what happened that changed the country around? You know, we were just going into Watergate and Vietnam. It was growing more and more horrendous. And one would think just logically that there would be a left-wing backlash, you know, that there would be not against the left-wing, but for it. And I contend that the whole apparatus, that is the media and the politicians, came out attacking the left. You know, we were the people who spat on the soldiers and all that stuff. And I just disagree with it. And I think that would that set the tone for the conservative movement that Reagan finally led.
Yeah, he ran against the 60s. Rick Wilson.
Right. Well, that's an interesting perspective and a legitimate one. I see things slightly differently. A lot of people remember the 60s as, and certainly the early 70s is a time in which there was this far left, kind of new left ascendancy. It didn't get too far. But I would see the 60s in that period as a time in which the most important concept was one of division, of the idea that the people who disagreed with you were, not to be trusted. And that's the real ground change in American political culture that takes place. And really startlingly, just kind of you see it locking into place piece by piece in the period between, say, 1961, when Kennedy was inaugurated, through the Cuban Missile Crisis, through the beginning of the civil rights uprising in Alabama, through the Kennedy assassination, and through 1964, so that by 1965, you really have these two warring camps of Americans who can't really speak to each other as easily as they could before. You could say they couldn't speak to each other before because no one liked to say rude things in public before the 60s came around.
And, of course, one of the rude things in public was not to talk about segregation in the South, if you happen to be a Democratic politician.
Sure, it was a sectional issue, not a moral issue.
I'm Jack Beatty. We're revisiting the 1964 presidential election campaign between Barry Goldwater and Lyndon B. Johnson. Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to tell us which man's world we live in today. This is The Connection on NPR. I'm Jack Beatty. This is The Connection. We're talking about Barry Goldwater today, the election of 1964, and we're taking a new look at the 1960s. Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join in the conversation. With me today is Rick Perlstein, author of Before the Storm, and Professor Robert Dalek, author of a two-volume biography of Lyndon B. Johnson, Lone Star Rising and Flawed Giant. Annie is on the line. Hello. Annie?
Hello?
Are we looking for Annie on the line?
My name isn't Annie.
Oh, okay. Well, who are you?
My name's Ted.
Okay, Ted.
So maybe you want
to... No, we'll talk to you.
Oh, okay, great.
Great.
That's really nice of you.
Sure, we're flexible.
Huh?
Right.
Yeah.
We're liberal here.
Yeah, that's pretty. That's
Don't
pretty,
say
pretty,
that.
Considering you were expecting Annie, I just wanted to say, you were talking about Lyndon B. Johnson and Goldwater there, and you were talking about who's. Hey, Mom, could you turn down the radio so I don't have to hear myself talking? Sorry about that. You're talking about whose world we lived in today, and I don't think that. I think we're kind of living in a, obviously because Bush is president and stuff. It's kind of like conservative. Reemergence, but I don't think it has as much to do with, Johnson and Goldwater. I don't think that, I think Goldwater probably lost because he wasn't a very great conservative, He was kind of not the, I think maybe the phenomenal job done by, Ronald Reagan and...
So he wasn't up to Ronald Reagan.
Well, Ronald Reagan and, obviously Nixon was not
right.
up to fluff either. But, um, Bush, not in the same degree, not to the same degree
sure.
as Reagan, but the wonderful things Reagan did for the economy
okay.
Might have restored the nation's confidence in the conservative ticket's ability to benefit the nation.
Sure. Ted, thank you for the call, and you raise a very important point, the Reagan legacy from the 1964 campaign. Rick Perlstein.
Sure. History did not end in 1964, but let's not forget that Ronald Reagan got his start in national politics in that Barry Goldwater campaign. He was, you know, kind of fading in his career as a kind of a B-movie actor and television host and almost getting exclusively involved in conservative politics. He kind of joined this barnstorming circuit, giving speeches on anti-communism and big government and all the rest, and very much against the wishes of Barry Goldwater's top campaign managers. He was able to be weaseled on the air by his California supporters with a half-an-hour speech in support of Barry Goldwater.
And we're going to hear a cut from that speech.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny. We'll preserve for our children this, the last best hope of man on earth, or we'll sentence them to take the last step into 1,000 years of darkness. We will keep in mind and remember that Barry Goldwater has faith in us. He has faith that you and I have the ability and the dignity and the right to make our own decisions and determine our own destiny. Thank you very much.
That was Ronald Reagan speaking in 1964 on a famous television half-hour commercial for Barry Goldwater. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Terrence is on the line. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to ask about the influence of Carl Hess, who was the speechwriter for Goldwater and later became a famous libertarian. He went from being on the far right to being kind of a left libertarian. I wondered if that had anything to do with Goldwater's mellowing.
Carl Hess, who he?
It may well. He was a fascinating character, probably one of the most fun guys to write about in my book. He kind of quit high school. He was born in the Philippines, quit high school at the age of 15 to become a journalist, became kind of a bush pilot, a gunsmith, a raucous libertarian. He worked for H.L. Hunt for a while. He gadded about doing all kinds of things. But Goldwater loved him. He was a pilot, and he was a writer. And he wrote Goldwater speeches, a lot of them, in 1964. And he was a purist.
Yep.
He was about as hard as they come.
Did he write the extremism in defense of liberty line?
He didn't. That's a different story.
Okay.
But, you know, he wrote stuff, you know, just as hard. And Goldwater loved him because he never pulled a punch. And he later came out against the Vietnam War and became kind of left-wing anarchist who lived in a co-op and lived without money and had a tax lien against any property he should ever acquire. He died 1 or 2 years ago and has a memoir out.
Terrence, thank you for the call. Fascinating to hear about this little-known character and a character he was. We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Corey is on the line.
Hi. I wanted to congratulate Rick on a great book.
Thanks, Corey.
You're welcome. And a quick comment on the war on poverty. I think we do have to put it in a very specific historical perspective, which is that even if it started in 64, 65, it didn't last much past 68. And so the failure of the war on poverty, although the spending in Vietnam had a big thing to do with it, certainly Nixon helped to dismantle it very rapidly. So its failure was set in stone as early as 68. But I actually wanted to ask Rick a completely different question to kind of bring the story full circle back up to the present. Rick, I was wondering if Goldwater symbolized kind of the, not the death of conservatism, but really the birth of what would be the right-wing revolution. Do you see anyone on the left today who's kind of like the Barry Goldwater of the left?
Well, Corey brings up a great point. I think that I talk about 50s politics in which it was kind of seen as bad form to be disagreeable. And there's this broad centrist consensus. I think in certain ways the period we're living through now bears some resemblance, although the consensus we have now is center-right instead of center-left. So it's interesting to think of, you know, whether a new generation of people like Martin Luther King or Betty Friedan or Barry Goldwater, you know, people who see beyond sort of the stalemate of the present in a prophetic way and raise their voices in the tone of morality, which you so rarely see in the cynical world, political world today. You know, I won't venture a guess. Hopefully that person is out there in the radio audience. But myself and David Brooks, the Weekly Standard editor, have kind of a lovely agreement on the possibility that we might be entering a kind of wild swinging period of abnormal politics, shall we say, and it could come from the right and it could come from the left. And maybe there's some prophet or visionary out there, people like Betty Friedan and Dwight McDonald and people like that in the early 60s were selling millions of books.
Yeah.
You know, maybe
yeah.
someone will come out with a book that sells millions of copies that's written in that visionary grain and, right. you know, gets people started about globalization or something else.
Sure. Sure. Bob Dalek?
Well, I think it's a good point, but I don't see anyone on the horizon at the moment. It certainly is a strong or central part of American reformism that you need some spark. In the mm-hmm. 60s, it was civil rights that sparked that that movement. Of course, in the 30s, it was the Depression. And, of course, what you've had for over 30 years now is a kind of reaction against the Great Society. And, of course, the irony is, as I said before, these programs have not been dismantled. And when you ask people out there in the country, are you big government? Oh, no, they're against it. But what do you want to get rid of? Social Security, Medicare, change civil rights rules.
VA hospitals, mortgage deductions.
Yeah, I mean, they don't want to change anything.
National public radio?
Exactly. Well, it's
some people aren't so.
Yeah, the National Endowment for the Humanities. I mean, they really
right.
are not so keen to throw
right.
these things out.
They do.
But there's going to have to be a change in mood. There's going to have to be some kind of pronounced failure. I don't think this current Bush administration is doing all that well with the public at the moment. I don't think they like the Bush administration's unilateralism or its stance
sure.
on the environment. This is going to be a very important decision mm-hmm. that this current president makes about stem cell research because it's a kind of
sure.
defining issue.
Indeed. Indeed.
It could
Can I say one thing?
Thomas is calling from Sweden.
Hi, thank you for allowing me to join you. I have a question here, or rather a thought. I wonder if we really do have Barry Goldwater's brand of conservatism today, because if we did, everyone, even to their detriment, would be so terribly honest.
Good point.
Yeah. I think there are very few honest brokers in politics. There rarely are. And I mean, I think it's interesting. I think Bob just now gave a really wise and useful and sound restatement of the conventional wisdom in American politics just about, 1964, before the last kind of revolution in mores happened. So, I mean, I would just caution people to be alive to the contingency of history, its richness, its paradoxes.
And one of the things you point out is how wrong the pundits were about what was really going on in their own decade. James
yeah.
Reston,
yeah.
Walter Lippmann,
yeah.
errors and no facts. I mean,
yeah.
you
Well, Jack, it's always there's always a kind of subterranean impulse in this country, this subterranean politics, things are going on that we don't quite glimpse or don't quite understand. And then, of course, later they come into focus much more clearly.
Sure.
But one thing we should add to all this is the influence of television now.
Right.
I mean, this has changed the way American politics operates,
Indeed.
And I think the gentleman from Sweden puts his finger on it in a way that we get so much less candor because
yes.
there's so much spin doctoring.
I know.
Bush goes down to Texas, and his spin doctors are saying,
right.
it's a working holiday, how hard he's
right.
working.
Well, Bob, Barry Goldwater was beyond spin, and we have
right.
we have someone with a memory of it. Mark, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Hi.
Hey, Mark.
I'm from Boston,
okay.
and I went to a very conservative college, liberal arts college in Virginia, and he spoke there in 1966, and I was at an intimate dinner, and I sat next to him.
Mm-hmm.
He was a very nice fellow. He was a little off-putting because he would tell you immediately that he was a general in the Air Force Reserve. He had a tattoo on his hand that he got from a Native American tribe.
A fake Native American tribe.
A fake man, okay. All right, there you go. And he talked a little bit about his background, which was of a mixed heritage of Christians and Jews. And he had, I guess he inherited some of the money from the Goldwater department store of Phoenix, I guess.
A little more than some.
Yeah, okay. His honesty was I thought, even at 19, that it was a little simplistic, and he had an answer for everything. And as he grew older to be the eminent grays of the Republican Party, he seemed to be more moderate and modulated his tones a little bit. But he was a fascinating guy. Yes. He's a little frightening.
I'll bet he was.
He's a little frightening. And he autographed a paperback copy of his book for me.
Sure. You got an heirloom there.
I got an heirloom. And I think he was a great character.
He certainly was. Thank you very much for that.
No argument there.
Rick, read us out of this show with the last paragraph of
your book.
You want
me to give away the ending?
Yeah, give away the ending.
Okay, sure. Well, what's happening is I'm kind of running down the conventional wisdom, you know, kind of like the day after he won. The nation's leading students of American political behavior, Nelson Polsby and Aaron Wildavsky, speculated that if the Republicans nominated a conservative again, he would lose so badly, quote, we can expect an end to the competitive two-party system. Arthur Schlesinger put it most succinctly of all, we still know him, in Volume 4 of his magisterial History of American Presidential Elections, quote, the election results of 1964 seemed to demonstrate Thomas Dewey's prediction about what would happen if the parties were realigned on an ideological basis. The Democrats would win every election, and the Republicans would lose every election. At that, there seemed nothing more to say. It was time to close the book.
Thank you to Rick Perlstein, author of Before the Storm, and Robert Dalek, Boston University professor and author of a 2-volume biography of Lyndon B. Johnson, Lone Star Rising and Flawed Giant. To continue the conversation, you can go to our website, theconnection.org. We had help today from Kim Bashari, Darren Manoogian, and Tim Monroe, and interns Annie Cocord and Tom Jacobois. The Connection is produced by Graham Smith, Sean Carberry, Sarah Fields, Kelly Jones, Allison McNadam, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, Karen Schiffman, and Doug Shugerts. Our senior producer today is Tara Murphy. I'm Jack Beatty. This is The Connection.